Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. And it is a privilege to be invited to speak, in my opinion anyway, at the Inverell Forum. Not least of all because of the kind of people that are attracted to it and the kind of work that is done to make it a success. And so I count it a privilege to be able to be present and to discuss some of the issues with people who have a genuine concern for what's happening to the country and to share the kind of information that's available from people who do spend a lot of their own time and a lot of their own money and their own effort and initiative in a field in which 95%, I would think, of Australians have virtually no interest, and that is defending their freedom and that of their children. Now, it might be harsh to say that 95% of people have no interest in that, and probably not true, because if it's put in those terms, most people have an interest. Well, my freedom, it's important to me. But if you suggest that, therefore, you must have a look at some of the things that are happening in politics, take a personal interest, sacrifice a bit of your time, commit a bit of your energy and perhaps your substance to searching out what these truths may be and then doing something about it, well, that's a slightly different matter altogether. There are not very many people prepared to dedicate that sort of time and put on that sort of commitment. So I believe it's an important service for those who are prepared to put the time and the effort in to other Australians who need the information. Well, my task this morning is to talk about the GST. And I suppose, for the most part, everybody now has a pretty good idea of what that is and what it's for. But I believe there are still some basic questions that need to be asked about it that perhaps we've overlooked a bit. And the first one of all is, what is the GST? And where else does it work? Well, we know that they have a GST, or a goods and services tax, in New Zealand, because Dr. Hewson, who's proposing it and part of his fight back program, is saying, look, go to New Zealand and see what it's done for them. And anybody who's been there comes back with their tail between their legs shaking their heads. If you go and talk to New Zealanders, particularly if you talk to people in rural areas who have suddenly discovered that here is a new bureaucratic imposition on them that they must somehow try and handle, so you go to a cattle sale in Timaru, and the first thing they have to establish with the auctioneer before they start auctioning a pen of cattle is that inclusive or exclusive? Well, what they're talking about is the GST. Now, does the price of these cattle include goods and services tax, or does it exclude goods and services tax? So who is paying it, the vendor or the buyer? That's where they begin. It's a nightmare to them. But anyhow, we know they have a GST in New Zealand, and we know they have one in Canada, because that's what we're being asked to look at as one of the success stories of this new kind of tax. But you see, the GST is simply another name for an older form of tax that's been around now for about 30 years. And what they are really talking about is not a goods and services tax as such. That's a new name for a very old tax called the value-added tax. And if you assess the structure of the goods and services tax as being proposed to us, it is almost exactly the same as the value-added tax that the Europeans have been struggling with now for nearly 20 years. We'll come back to that a little bit later. But the truth is, we go on calling it the GST, I suppose, but the variation of the value-added tax that's proposed for Australia, as soon as the Liberal Party and the Coalition in general win the election, is one of the most complicated, vicious and punitive forms of taxation that man's ever devised. And I believe that we need to have that before us, understand that, before we make decisions on whether we're going to have it or whether we'd like to try something else. And the next question is, well, where did it come from? Did John Hewson wake up one morning and think, well, I need something different. I need something different from Paul Keating. Our programs are so similar, I need something different to distinguish me from the Labor Party, and suddenly hit upon this idea of a goods and services tax? Or his advisors, did they say, well, look, they're all talking about it in the bush. Can't we do what New Zealand's doing? Great idea. Scrap the income tax and go to a goods and services tax. Well, no, none of that happened. It's not an Australian idea at all. In fact, the genesis for the idea came from overseas, specifically from the International Monetary Fund. The IMF right around the world has been recommending indirect taxes, in particular the value-added tax, to every economy on earth. In fact, you'll find that when countries find themselves in financial difficulty and finish up at the mercy of the International Monetary Fund, the IMF has a program that they lay before them and they say, look, there is no problem. We are quite willing to lend you funds to get your economy out of trouble. usually in American dollars, of course. But there are some conditions, and these are the conditions, and I give them a little list. And some of the things on the list might surprise you a little bit, because they're the kind of things that we're now talking about in Australia. Now, it's not number one on the list, but fairly high up the list you'll find this question of a value-added tax. Now, we think, well, that doesn't apply to us. The good people in the Liberal Party and the National Party are our neighbours and our friends. They'd never think of subjecting us to a value-added tax. How's the GST? Quite different. Not very different at all. And also up near the top of the list are a number of other factors. And late last year, India found themselves in severe financial difficulty. And so the Indian government went to the International Monetary Fund and said, look, we're going to need an injection of capital of something like $2,000 million. Relatively small change, they tell me. And the International Monetary Fund said, there are no problems. We can manage that. But here's our little list. And they brought out the list, you see. And the first thing on their list was that the Indian government had to reorganise their economy so it wasn't quite so insular. Because, you see, for 15 years, although they've made a terrible mess of it, the Indians have had a program or a policy of economic self-sufficiency. That is, they do for themselves what they can. The International Monetary Fund said, no, what you need is to internationalise your economy. Open it right up to the global traders. And that means that your tariff barriers have got to come down. Your customs duty and the excise and all the rest has got to begin to come down to globalise your economy. And in the end, in order to get the cash, that's what the Indians had to agree to. So if you read the financial press now, you'll probably read that India are doing the same kind of things that we are. And I suppose it doesn't take long until we start to assess our own economic situation here, and the predictions have already been made by Peter Walsh, for one, former Minister of Finance, that unless we do something about our debt structure, the International Monetary Fund, in a period of 2 years or so, is probably going to begin taking interest in the Australian economy. And along will come the little list. Well, here's what we want you to do. Well, Dr. Hewson, of course, knows what the list has got on it quite well, because he used to work for the International Monetary Fund. Did a lot of his training there. As an economic modelist, whatever that is, playing with computers. Apparently, if you have a good enough computer model, then you can tell people what's going to happen to the economy. And you can tell them how to fix it, too. And one of the answers to fix the Australian economy, apparently, is a new kind of tax, a goods and services tax. But according to the press, late last year, the story came out, particularly in the Financial Review, that the International Monetary Fund had specifically gone to the opposition and said, look, we will help you float the concept of a GST in Australia. In fact, the report here says that the International Monetary Fund has virtually produced a how-to book for the opposition leader, Dr. Hewson, and the Shadow Treasurer, Mr. Reith, explaining how to sell the GST to the public, how to placate noisy lobby groups, deflect the political blowtorch, which I see we've got there ready to hand. Makes me a bit nervous, Mr. Chair. I must say, this blowtorch here. Yeah, I'm aware of that, but deflect the political blowtorch from within their own party and within the ALP and get the new system up and running. And the IMF study notes the relatively short parliamentary term in Australia, but says that the value-added tax, now notice this, they're not talking about the GST, they are talking about a value-added tax. It says the value-added tax has become such a well-known and widely adopted tax that the lead time to introduce it has shortened considerably, and 18 months is a reasonable figure to aim for. And then it just goes on to say that a GST or value-added tax is simply a consumption tax. They talk about the thing in the same breath and regard it as virtually the same structure, the same instrument. And let's not be deceived, it is an instrument. It is not simply another method of collecting the revenue a government needs to run the economy. We'll come back to that in a minute. It is an instrument. And the International Monetary Fund regards the instrument as applicable to countries like Australia, who up until now have been relatively independent, and I say that in relative terms. Well, the question is, well, who else has this GST or the value-added tax, apart from Canada and New Zealand? And there are a lot of countries. In fact, there are 34 countries at the present time that have a value-added tax, or variations of it. And another 6 countries that are considering it and proposing to implement it in the next couple of years. So the International Monetary Fund over the last 15 years has been relatively successful in selling a value-added tax to a lot of these countries. And it's not just the struggling third world countries who've had financial problems. Some of the most advanced countries in the world. The United States doesn't have one yet of the same kind. If you look down the list, and they've got most of the European countries, quite a few of the Eastern European countries, and of course a fair range of the third world countries as well. But if you look specifically at some of the examples of where the value-added tax has been used. And the one we know best and the one we've heard most about is New Zealand, because Dr. Hewson went over there last year to talk to the New Zealanders who are now trying to administer that tax. Now, the New Zealand tax was introduced in 1986. And in 1986, they didn't have a National Party government or a Conservative government. They had a Labor Party government. And it was introduced by a man called Roger Douglas. And Mr. Douglas is credited with a new kind of economics in New Zealand. In fact, so closely is it identified with Mr. Roger Douglas that they call it Rogernomics. And Rogernomics is a term that applies to what he did to the New Zealand economy, internationalised the New Zealand economy, and did exactly what the IMF is suggesting that India should do now. That is, begin to eliminate the tariff barriers and the customs duties and all the protective measures that New Zealand industry has depended on virtually in the last 100 years. Floated the New Zealand currency and introduced this new tax, the goods and services tax. And the argument that was put before it was introduced in New Zealand was that this tax will actually bring the tax take down. It will reduce tax liability for all New Zealanders. What they were going to do was decrease income tax levels right down to a point where you'd hardly even notice them and increase indirect taxes across the board on everything. On everything, with only two exceptions that I know of. So that means that you pay tax on everything you do. Every single transaction that you undertake must be recorded and must have a certain amount set aside, in their case, 12.5% now, for the Inland Revenue Department. Everything. As far as I know, you pay taxes on your rates. A GST goes on top of your rates. On your postage stamps, you pay for your stamps plus GST. Your water rates, everything that moves. And most things that don't move. One of the few things that is exempt is taxes on your rent. You don't pay a GST on your rent, which I thought was mighty big of them. But the record shows, if you look at what happened in New Zealand, that the GST, or the value-added tax, has dramatically increased the indirect tax take without slowing down the income tax much at all. See, there's a little bit of sleight of hand has taken place. Because while the direct tax has been brought down, that is, the income tax has been reduced, the things that the income tax used to buy for you have also been reduced because of Mr. Douglas's Rogernomics program and the privatisation of the New Zealand economy. For example, things like the power boards have now been privatised. Things like the water systems are being privatised. The government services that they used to take for granted, which was paid for by their direct taxes out of their incomes, are no longer there. And there is a user pays philosophy, which means that if you are using any of those services, then you pay the full amount. There's no government subsidisation anymore. So you see, you're paying less tax to the government, but you're now paying for some of the services that you used to take for granted. So therefore, the New Zealand dollar goes less, or doesn't go as far as they expected it to go. If you look at the total indirect taxes, that is what they used to have in the terms of sales tax, the indirect tax under the GST regime has nearly tripled. So it's increased enormously. The figures show that in 1986, when the GST was introduced, income tax amounted to 9.1 billion New Zealand dollars. And in 1990, some 4 years later, they'd increased the income tax, that is, it increased from 9.1 billion New Zealand dollars to 14 billion New Zealand dollars. And that was the tax that was supposed to go down dramatically. So I don't know what Mr. Hewson found out when he was in New Zealand talking to the National Party, but there's a lesson in it for us, and the first lesson is that if one party introduces a value-added tax, as the Labor Party did in New Zealand, the next party that comes into government very, very rarely ever even discusses the possibility of eliminating that tax. The National Party in New Zealand at one stage campaigned against the GST and said, we'll remove the thing if we get into power. But we never, ever heard any more about it. When the National Party found themselves with their feet under the desk, they discovered that the goods and services tax was such an efficient instrument for collecting revenue, there's no way they were going to dismantle that thing. And if we ask ourselves here in Australia about the Labor Party, now are the Labor Party campaigning vigorously against the GST? Are they saying, look, if the Liberals ever get the chance to introduce this thing, we're going to dismantle it the very first chance we get? No, of course they're not. Because back in 1984 or 1985, at the time of the tax summit, the strongest proponent of a GST was the best treasurer in the world, Paul Keating. And so now I suppose the world's greatest prime minister is in a cleft stick. He can't vigorously campaign against the thing because the opposition and most of Australia know very well that he was the first to propose it here. So once it's in, I think it goes without saying that we're all certainly stuck with it. To shift from the New Zealand experience to another part of the world, to Canada. Now, the goods and services tax was introduced there much more recently. It was only about a year ago. And once again, Australian commentators have been saying, well, look at the Canadian experience. It's been terribly successful and the people are accepting it quite readily. But if you go to Canada and talk to Canadian people or read their press, their papers, enormous bitterness about this new tax. You see, their tax is 15% in Canada, as ours is proposed to be. But our economists and our media commentators and the Liberal Party here in Australia are telling us that the Canadian GST is 7%. Well, it is at the federal level. But what they're not telling us is that below the federal level, there's also provincial goods and services tax, or sales tax, whatever it's called in different provinces. And so when you add the 7%, which is a GST or a national tax, on top of the provincial tax, it brings it up to a level of about 15%, which is what's proposed for us. And while starry-eyed people like Dr. John Hewson and Peter Reith are saying, look, it's terrific in Canada, everyone's terribly happy about it, the evidence is not there for that. In fact, in those provinces where they have a common border with the United States, British Columbia, Alberta, for example, the cross-border trade has quadrupled in a period of about 2 weeks. And why has that happened? Because there's no GST in the United States or no value-added tax. And so everybody from Vancouver in British Columbia is getting in the car after work and dashing down below the border before the shop's shut to do their shopping. And the Americans fairly quickly realised this, so what did the Americans do? Well, they extended their trading hours so it'd be a little bit easier. Canadians could come down after work, no problem. It's only an hour's drive. I've been down there myself. When I visited Canada once, people I was staying with in Vancouver, look, they said, the price is down in Bellingham, below the border. Let's go down. So away they go for a drive, take all the family, have a nice meal down there, do all the shopping after hours. And the biggest problem that the Canadians face now is a smuggling problem, because everybody's trying to smuggle their groceries north of the border. And of course, the Canadians get fairly touchy about it. At least the customs authorities do. So the Canadian press now tell us that the cross-border shopping has reached record levels, so much so that one provincial government briefly considered a punitive departure tax on vehicles crossing the border. This particular report was saying that people are fleeing to the United States to escape the crippling effects of provincial and federal taxes. In Ontario, for example, those taxes add 15% to everything, 8% provincial tax and 7% GST. It was estimated recently, this is only in January this year, it was estimated recently by a leading business organisation in Canada that the cost of implementing or administering the GST, which is a private business cost that's imposed on you once the thing goes through, which is all passed on to consumers, mind you, because business simply cannot afford that additional margin, as anyone who runs a business knows very well. It's got to be passed on to consumers, otherwise business ceases to operate. But the additional cost that's passed on to consumers in the first year was $20,000 million. Now, that's not the additional tax that was collected over and above the cost of consumer items. That was simply the bill to Canadian business for administering the tax for the tax department in Canada. $20,000 million. Because almost every business has now got to employ additional staff just to administer the tax. And the only way they can afford to do that is to pass on the cost to the consumer. Where else do you find wages for an extra member of the staff? And equipment. They're now selling special computer programs so that you can satisfy the Inland Revenue Department to get all the taxes paid. And the record showed last year, after the Gulf War, that Brian Mulroney's popularity was so low that he envied the popularity rating that Saddam Hussein was raising around the world, which is a bit of a testament to what the VAT did to his government. Well, you can move from there to Britain, and Britain have had a goods and services tax now, I think, for 19 years, introduced in 1973. When it was first brought in, it was first brought in at a rate of 7%. But it fairly soon became obvious that the British were so terribly enthusiastic about it that they jacked it up from 7% now to 17%. In fact, 17.5%. It's just gone up another 2.5% last year, I think. And naturally enough, Britain and other European community countries are now all adopting standardised VAT legislation, because when the British go into this new sovereign entity at the end of 1993, Europe, they've all got to have the same rules. particularly in tax collection. Otherwise, what's happening in North America now between Canada and the United States is going to be tripled up in Europe. Obviously, if you've got French living on the border with, well, any of their borders, and the French GST is 20% and the German GST, say, for example, is 10%, where are you going to shop? Well, you'd be across that border in a flash to Germany. There will be no restrictions about crossing the borders because it will be one super government, one super state. It will no longer be France as a sovereign state alongside Germany as a sovereign state, with Spain down in the south and Italy and somewhere else. It'll just be one huge super state. The European community, consisting of 12 countries, takes on a sovereign entity in its own right at the end of 1993. And the planning for that's been going on now for over 30 years. The British were asked about that. Do you want it or do you not want it? Back in 1972, and there was a debate took place, are we going to become a part of the European Economic Community? And I've seen the publications that were produced by the government. There is the case for the yes vote, and there is the case for the no vote. And when you look at it, fairly compelling arguments for the yes vote. They are saying, look, our industrial costs will come down. Our duties, customs, all the rest will come down. We'll have agreements with other European countries. There'll be cross-border trade facilitated. We'll be able to sell on a European market without being punished by levies and duties. And the no case wasn't a terribly sophisticated case. And so the British, in 1972, I think it was, voted yes, let's go into the European Economic Community. But what they didn't realise was that the European Economic Community was simply the first stage of a much longer programme that stretched 30 or 40 years down the track. And it wasn't an economic community they were joining at all in the long run, but a political community. And that political community was to become a brand new country, Europe. It is not a collection of sovereign countries at all, because the countries that are going into it are giving up all kinds of sovereign powers that they've exercised, some of them for over 1,000 years, as Britain itself is, of course. In order to organise that European community financially and economically, they're standardising the rules, among them the tax rules, and all European countries now who are going into that new entity have got to have a VAT, and they're now trying to standardise the rate of the VAT, or the goods and services tax. So, for example, Luxembourg and Spain are being made to lift their VAT rate from 12% up to 15%, because that's the standard rate that the European community want to impose, 15% right across the board. Well, I don't know what that means in Britain. Perhaps they're going to have to bring theirs back down to 15%. But them's the breaks. Some of the other European countries have had a VAT for quite a long time. Sweden, for example, has had a VAT. And if you meet people who come from Sweden, they say, look, for God's sake, do not introduce a VAT in Australia or a GST or whatever you want to call it. I came to Australia to escape that thing. There's a letter in the Bulletin in December last year from a lady called Lagerstedt who says, look, I came here to escape that blasted tax. I'm now an Australian. I'm a citizen. I converted. I left everything behind me in Europe because there was not a single European country that I could go to that could not be expected to introduce this dreadful tax. So here I am, and now you're talking about introducing it down here. Well, by golly, she says, I'm an Australian, and I'm going to oppose this thing, and I've got experience that you people haven't gotten. You'd better get your minds around that. And the same story's coming out of Holland. Another letter in the same edition of the Bulletin alongside the other one from a Dutchman who says that this form of tax, which in Holland was 18.5%, is manna from heaven for the tax man and a windfall for any government. And he points out that once a government gets its hands on a value-added tax as an instrument for collecting revenue, they have never, ever given it up. The record shows that no government has ever abolished a value-added tax or a GST. So that's part of the European experience. It can go to the absurd, as it has done from time to time in Italy, because in Italy they now have what they call the finance police. It's not really funny, but the finance police had to be organised in order to make sure that people were paying the VAT, because there's something in the Italian that I suppose the Australian identifies with, and it's a rebellion against authority. And we've always said in Australia that the fastest growing industry is the tax avoidance industry, or the tax evasion industry sometimes. And it appears that the same applies in Italy, because when the GST was introduced in Italy back in 1973, at the same time it was introduced in Britain, it was introduced at 19%. 19%. And every second Italian went straight up the wall. And the only way that they could make sure that tax was collected was to introduce punitive legislation for fines and make it compulsory for those who buy anything to have a receipt. anything you buy, you must have a receipt. The onus is on the consumer to prove that he has paid GST. And if he cannot produce a receipt for what he's bought, then not only is the consumer fined, but so also is the retailer where he's bought it, or the wholesaler, or whatever it might be. Early this month, they had the case of the finance police arrested a child at the age of 3. And the child was arrested at the age of 3 because her mother had taken her into a chocolate bar because the kid was misbehaving. In order to try and silence the child, or at least quieten it down, she went into a shop. I can just imagine how it is. My wife has exactly the same problem, except she buys them chips. Into the shop. Look, there's a packet of chips now. Sit down and shut up and let me do the shopping. And so the kid sits there and eats junk food for 15 minutes while mum goes and gets the shopping finished. But in this case, in Italy, mum went and bought the child a chocolate, and I suppose gave it the chocolate and said, well, look, shut up while I do the shopping. But next thing, tap on the shoulder. The finance police. Madam, have you got your receipt for the chocolate bar you've just bought young Enrico? Receipt? 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 This is a mother trying to do the shopping. You've been there. With 2 kids or 3 kids, it's a nightmare. With 1 kid, it's bad enough. And she's got to find a receipt for a chocolate bar, and she couldn't find it. She probably didn't get one. Who's going to worry about a receipt when you're trying to do the shopping with kids in tow? So, okay, she was arrested and back to the retailer. She was fined on the spot, apparently. The fine was 300,000 lira. Sorry, that was the shopkeeper's fine, 300,000 lira, which comes to about $320. And that's happened again and again. It's not the first case. There was a case previous to that, also a child, whose father was fined because the child couldn't produce a receipt for a bag of popcorn. This is the Italian finance police prosecuting kids in the street because they can't produce receipts. I'm not suggesting that's going to happen here. I'm just pointing out that the VAT in Britain has produced all kinds of anomalies, and that's one of them. There's only one country that I know of that has a form of resistance to the VAT that seems to me worth looking at. And of the countries that now proposes to go into this new sovereign entity called Europe at the end of 1993, Switzerland is one. Early last year, the Swiss government began to introduce the legislation to change the Swiss tax structure and introduce the VAT that would comply with the European legislation. And as the legislation was being introduced, some terribly reactionary person out in the fringes somewhere in one of the provinces, or cantons they call them, said to somebody else, well, wait a minute, I never said I wanted a VAT. How come these guys can introduce a VAT? A GST? They never offered me an opportunity to vote on that. By hell, I don't like that. I'm going to do something about that. And so what did they do? They took up a petition. They took up a petition saying, look, we never approved a VAT for Switzerland. And if we didn't approve it, then we're not going to have it. And we demand that you don't introduce it. Well, we've seen petitions in Australia. They go up and down the country, and they finish up in Canberra, and they go down to the vaults downstairs. Don't know if anyone ever looks at them. No notice ever taken of them much, I suppose, except the local member reads into Hansard, well, I've got a petition from Mrs. Walsh and 322 other people saying this and that. And down it goes. But it's a bit different in Switzerland, you see, because they've got a mechanism there. And when this person went around the provinces, and the petition started going round the cantons and raised 50,000 signatures within a period of 3 months, then they took that petition to the government and said, well, here we are. We're presenting our petition. We don't want that thing. And the petition means that the government's compelled to hold a referendum on a VAT. And so I think it was the end of May, early June last year, in Switzerland, they had a referendum on a VAT. And an overwhelming number of people said, not on your life. Things are bad enough now in Switzerland. No way are we going to have a VAT. And so the rules state that now that the people have had a say on VAT, the Swiss government is prohibited from introducing the VAT. So we don't know what that means for Switzerland. It's thrown the constitutional experts into a bit of a spin. They've now got to go back to the books and back to the legislation to try and work out, well, what does this mean? Does it mean that in the long term, the people have got some mechanism for keeping the Swiss out of the European community, out of this new emerging regional supergovernment that is supposed to be the prototype for at least 2 other supergovernments around the globe. One of them in North America, on the American continent, and the other one down here in the Pacific, as Brian Wiltshire was saying yesterday, a Pacific Basin Economic Community. And we think that's a new idea. We think, well, I suppose we've got to talk about it. Someone's raised it. But it's not a new idea at all. The discussion for the Pacific Basin Community has been going on for 15 years. When I first went to New Zealand in 1979, they were talking about it then. A lot of thought has gone into the proposal. A lot of the planning has already been completed. In fact, one of the people who's been heavily involved in it, a New Zealand Member of Parliament who briefly became the Prime Minister after Geoffrey Palmer was rolled in the last Labor government, is a man called Mike Moore. And Moore has already produced the book called The Pacific Parliament. And it is a set of proposals about how a European community, not an economic community, mind you, a political community, can be governed, modelled in some respects on the European Parliament, which is the new prototype government for that particular regional super-government. So you see, we're not talking about vague proposals that may or may not be raised in the future. We're talking about legislation or mechanisms, which is what I said before the VAT appears to me to be, a mechanism to drive people into certain situations, one of them being a regional super-government to fit in with everybody else in the same region. Now, here in Australia, the debates still go on about the GST, except I find now as I go around the place that most people just switch off. They switch off when you talk about the opposition's fight back program. They switch off when you talk about Keating's One Nation program, because they're fed up with the economics of it. Without even looking at the figures, they suspect that somehow, as a result of these programs, they're going to get skinned. They suspect somehow that if the government is introducing a new tax, or the opposition is proposing a new tax, then it's going to be for the benefit of the government, not for the benefit of the taxpayer. And I think that instinctively is the best feeling. I think it is right. And if we had a mechanism like the Swiss had, I think the opposition would find, to their horror, which they already suspect, that a big majority of people would not accept that GST if they could avoid it. But it now appears to be a case of people in desperation looking for something different. People who are so economically desperate that they will look at any straw that comes along that they think would have any chance of improving the situation, even if it's only temporarily, so they can get through the next 12 months and save their properties or their business, or avert the bank moving a liquidator in or an accountant or something like that. But it's become increasingly evident since the launching of Mr. Keating's One Nation package that what he has done is simply had a look at the fightback package and matched all the numbers, matched all the figures. The tax reductions, well, he's matched them. Everything else, Mr. Keating's been able to match. The question mark is, well, where are you going to get the money to do these things? And as soon as that question is asked, Mr. Keating says, well, that's a reactionary question that's asked from the point of view of British imperialism, and we've got to have a republic to solve that problem. We've got to change the flag and scrap the Union Jack and become more Australian and more nationalistic and more proud of our country, and we'll stagger through somehow. But don't ask me where the money's going to come from. When they ask the opposition, Mr. Houston says, well, we've done all our figures in the best number-crunching fashion. If you look at the figures, it says that if we introduce a 15% GST and drop your direct taxes right down, then the money will just roll in and we'll finance those things, no problem. Which I believe. But the question is, do we want the things that are being proposed? And do we want them paid for in that fashion? And so, until yesterday, it appeared that the provisions of both the opposition and the government's policies were quite similar, except for this question of a GST, or that is, the mechanism for paying the bills for the proposals. But then 2 days ago, a few interesting things happened. And I suppose, to pick it up, we've got to go back to the by-election down in Wills, a seat that was held until the last election, quite comfortably, by the Prime Minister, Mr. Hawke. But during that last election, he suffered a reverse of something like 8%, swing against him, and to his horror, he had to go to preferences in order to hold the seat, which meant that it was no longer a safe seat, it was now a marginal seat. And so both the government and the opposition have been pouring tremendous resources into that seat to try and capture it, particularly for propaganda reasons. They believe that the person who wins that seat has the best chance of winning the next election. That's their analysis on both sides. But a new fact has been injected into that by-election because it seems to be the focus of national attention for about the rest of this month and early next month. And there are huge numbers of independent candidates standing. In fact, there are now 22 candidates standing for the by-election at Wills. Now, that's a national record, the biggest number of candidates that ever stood for a single electorate in history in Australia was 12. So Wills has superseded that by 10 candidates. So if you can imagine getting hold of that voting slip in the booths in a couple of weeks, they've got 22 names to try and sort through. One of those names is a very interesting character. He's a man called Cleary, Pat Cleary, I think his name is, who's local. And he happens to be particularly well known because he is one of those who the Victorians look up to. He's a Victorian League footballer, almost a religion down there. Unless you had a different religion up here, like rugby, you wouldn't understand it. But the Victorians, everything stops on a Saturday afternoon for the VFL, or the Australian Football League as it now is. And this chap, Phil Cleary is his name, comes out of that background. He's one of the wizards or one of the priests of the VFL religion. He's the local coach and particularly well known, and he's thrown his hat into the ring. He's standing as an independent. That in itself is not unusual, because there's about 20 other independents too. But what Cleary is saying is unusual, and it follows a pattern that's been established in other parts of the world, but has yet to be demonstrated here in Australia. And that pattern is that he is going against what they call the bipartisan economic policies of the government and the opposition. He is saying, look, I hear what you're saying about a level playing field. I hear what you're saying about free trade. I hear what you're saying about slowly eliminating the tariff barriers and the custom duties and all the rest, so that we can become an internationally competitive country and vigorously compete on the world markets and prove ourselves as among the best in the world. But he says, I also live in Coburg or Brunswick or wherever it is, in Wills. And he says, I've got neighbours. And I know that the unemployment rate here is about 19% overall. And I know very well that it's about 35% for young people. So he said, my perception is that your policies of a level playing field and internationalising the Australian market and the global market and all the rest, they're hurting our people here in Coburg on the street. There are 80 firms in the seat of Wills that deal with goods like footwear, clothing or textiles. And they are being absolutely massacred. Philip Cleary is saying, if I'm elected, I'm going to start a national campaign to eliminate this business of a level playing field. I'm going to start a campaign to reintroduce some of the tariffs and some of the duties and some of the protective measures that these people require to survive. And he's pointing to other places all over Australia, and he's saying, look at the devastation of the industrial landscape right around the country. And the others are picking this up. And John Hewson hears this and he thinks, boy, that's a bit inflammatory. I better get down there and shake a few hands and kiss a few babies. But Paul Keating has got a much better mental political tuning, in my opinion, than John Hewson has. And Paul Keating hears this too, and he thinks, I had better change the tune a little bit. How can I reorganise the rhetoric so that the people of Coburg and the people of Brunswick think that I am going to start backing off this question of tariffs and taxes and the level playing field? So 2 days ago, Keating came out in the press and was belted thoroughly in Parliament for saying, well, look, when we said that we wanted a level playing field and when we said that we're going to eliminate the tariff barriers by the year 2000, well, look, we didn't really mean it. We didn't mean it. We were just saying that. We meant it'd be a good idea and it'd be a great thing if we could do it. But no, look, we're the good guys. We're not going to do it. And the thing that interests me is this is a pattern that's been repeating itself in other places. Up in North America in the election campaign, particularly in the primaries, you've probably noticed there's a character called Pat Buchanan. Some of you have been following, I suppose, what he's doing and what he's saying. He basically is saying, look, Americans have got to put America first for a change. All right, the Cold War's finished, the Soviet threat apparently receded. What we've got to do is now straighten out things at home. So he's saying we've got to protect our own industry, we've got to protect our own primary producers. We've got to do things for ourselves for a change. All this business about globalising trade and internationalising the markets, absolutely not on. Pity about the Australians and their wheat. They're trying to sell in all parts of the world, but by golly, they don't vote for us. American farmers vote for us, and we've got to take the interest of American farmers to heart. And it appears to me that this kind of argument is badly, badly damaging George Bush. I can see people in tears all over the place. That's what's happening. So in my opinion, the goods and services tax in itself is bad enough, but I believe it is available to those who can wield it as an instrument or a weapon to force people into doing things that they wouldn't otherwise do, particularly force people into financing a central government that is potentially out of their control completely. So the bell says I come to a halt, and I willingly do that, but leave you with a reminder that the GST has been tried in other parts of the world under different names, particularly the VAT, and I fail to see anything in any material that I've seen anywhere that it can improve the Australian situation, that it can answer some of the questions that are being raised and some of the problems that are hurting us in Australian industry. Thank you very much.